Good evening, welcome back, and thanks for coming back. I know we're a little bit sparse. I think a lot of people are out sick, but I'm really thankful for those of us who have been able to gather tonight to worship God and to just be more transformed, to be more like His Son. And tonight's lesson is going to really follow up from this morning's lesson. This morning's lesson, I kind of ended with this real challenging thing, I think I find challenging anyway, of once you see what the Bible actually says about suffering, it's extreme. It's not just suffering's a bad thing, but we can put up with it. It's that Christians oftentimes have to choose to suffer. We actually have to pursue a life that involves suffering, consciously seeing that I'm going to have to suffer, but that's the choice I'm going to make to follow Christ. And I presented several passages there at the end of the lesson that said that. There's so many more passages in the New Testament that make that point, which is a sobering thought. And so this evening, I wanted to dig further into that because it's just such a difficult thing. How do you apply that to your life? What does that look like? And rather than preaching a lesson where I look at specific decisions we make that go that way, which I think would be helpful to look at specific things, that here's something specifically I need to do that would involve suffering, that kind of thing. But rather than doing that, I thought I'd take a step back and think, you know, really this has bigger implications than that. If God has called us to a life of suffering, then that's going to not just affect one or two or three or four decisions I make in my life. It's really going to affect the kind of the whole goal and basis that I have for my life. And so here's the lesson tonight. Here's what I've titled it. Title it, The Ideal Life. When you think about your life and you think about what you'd like your life to be, what do you see as the ideal life? How would you picture your ideal life? Now, many of us have probably thought about that, or even if you haven't thought about that, you probably have subconsciously thought about that. I think all of us at least have some kind of vague idea in our mind of kind of what would be ideal. And we kind of know when things aren't ideal. We kind of know that, yeah, things didn't go quite like I wish they had. So if you're just going to picture the ideal life, here's a list I put together of, this is what I think probably most of us would see as an ideal life, or most people, maybe I shouldn't say most of us, most people would say is an ideal life. So, and you can think about if this would fit your list or not, maybe some of the things more than others. But here's a typical type list. So I think a good family would probably be on most of our ideal lives. We would think, I'd like to have either your kids or your wife, or if you don't have kids or a wife, just maybe your parents or whatever. You'd like to have a good family relationship. So we'd say that would be part of an ideal life. Close friendships, meaningful relationships with others. We'd say that's part of having an ideal life. Most of us would like to have some kind of good friends that we could count on. Another one would be, you think about how you are economically. Enough money that you can, things seem stable and you can have, you aren't worrying about how much money you have. And for each of us, that this one might be different. For you, it might be that the ideal life is have way more money. I mean, it may be that the ideal life is you're going to have your own private jet or something, but for other people, it might be the ideal life is just, you know, kind of about what I have, or maybe a little bit more than what I have, but just enough to be comfortable. Another thing would be a job. A lot of us would picture our ideal life. We'd have some kind of job, but a fun job, a job you enjoy, a job you can go to work at and you feel fulfilled at it and isn't overly challenging, but challenging enough to feel fulfilling. Another one might just be a life free from tragedy. I think when tragedies happen, we feel like, well, that was not ideal. That's not what the ideal life should be like. So even if you feel like the ideal life should have maybe a few ups and downs, we would say the ideal life would be one that's there's no major tragedies. Another thing would be having the time and the ability to pursue your dreams and desires. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean good things like hobbies or vacations or things that you've always dreamed of doing. In the ideal life, we'd say that that's something I'd be able to pursue. All right, so that's a pretty standard picture of what the ideal life is. And I think if we maybe went around and interviewed people, we might get a list that's pretty similar to that for most people with a few variations. Now, you notice there's nothing on there that's really Christian about that. So I think for us as Christians, we'd probably add something to that list that would be a little more God-centered. So you might at least add something like this, be an active member of a faithful church. An ideal life, as Christians, we'd say the ideal life is where you have this active relationship with God and you're in His church. It's a good church. And that would be a good essential part of an ideal life. It's interesting how it's just kind of tacked on at the end. All right, so that would be a picture of what we might see as the ideal life. And I think for a lot of us, we could look at that and say, well, I could kind of find some Bible verses that would kind of go along with that. And so I'd say that's maybe a kind of biblical concept of an ideal life. The problem is to try to mesh it up with this morning's sermon. Where does choosing suffering fit in to that ideal life? Choosing suffering is not even something we just tack in on as another item at the end. Because choosing suffering actually is diametrically opposed to most of the items on this list. And so that starts to make you wonder, is this really the ideal life according to God? Is that what the ideal life would be for a Christian? And while there's a lot of ways we could kind of squish verses in here and say, there's verses that talk about our family, so a good family seems like an ideal life. There's verses about friends, so that seems like the ideal life. And we could put verses with most of these, and we could say, yeah, this is the ideal Christian life. But instead of doing that, what if we just erased all this and we started with the New Testament and we said, okay, without any preconceived ideas, what does the New Testament say is the ideal life? And just started from a totally different perspective. I don't think we'd end up with this. I think if we don't have these kinds of preconceived ideas and we simply just went wherever the Bible led us, I don't think we'd end up with this particular list. Now, I don't think these are really sinful things. I think these are pretty much all of these are good things. But is that really what the New Testament describes as the ideal life that we as Christians need to be pursuing? When I was trying to think through this, here's the first idea I came to. The ideal life in the New Testament, and I think you'll agree with this, the ideal life in the New Testament is Jesus. When you go through the New Testament, what do they hold up as the ideal? It's Jesus. Jesus is the ideal. He's the one we need to follow over and over again. So what if instead of looking at this list, we started with Jesus and said, hey, what if Jesus is our ideal? Now, we could see Jesus as the ideal role model, but would we say that Jesus' life itself is the ideal life? We probably wouldn't, because you look at his life and it's filled with all these unfortunate situations that are not ideal. It's filled with tragedy. It's filled with suffering. And so we say it's not the ideal life. But according to this morning's sermon, from all those verses we looked at, suffering is not something that we're supposed to be wanting to run from. Many times we have to choose that. And when you look at how the New Testament Christians follow Jesus, they followed him into his suffering. So what if Jesus' life is what the New Testament Christians saw as the ideal life? So just follow me down that road for a minute. Let's think about it. If we were going to make an outline of Jesus' life, here's the way I would do it, and we could make it a few different ways, but here's just some kind of key points I would see in it. It starts out with him lowering himself. As far as he was in heaven with God, but just being born on this earth meant that he came all the way down and this extreme humbling of himself, lowering himself. So that would be the first point. Next, I would say, you look at his life and he's just constantly serving other people. It's just this life of tireless service to all these different people as he's doing all these miracles to heal people. And just read through the Gospels over and over again. You could look further on and One of the things you see in the Gospels a lot is this close relationship that he has with God, this constant dependence on God, constantly praying to God. So his relationship seems to be key to it. Another one would be the way that he pursues God's mission of constantly teaching people and constantly doing God's work all the way to death on the cross. I mean, he pursues this mission just with the utmost zeal. And then finally, that culminates with him dying and his victory in his death and him rising again and being enthroned in heaven. So that would be, I think, a basic outline of Jesus' life. Now, could we look at that and say, looked at. So let's just compare the two. Here's our typical ideal. Here's Jesus's life. We could say, well, Jesus just totally failed at the ideal life, that Jesus's life, I mean, this is opposite of this in so many ways. We could say, well, Jesus's life was not ideal in any way. But what if from God's perspective, this is the ideal life? And as I read through the New Testament, more and more, I think that this is how the New Testament Christians saw the ideal life being. Now, if that's the case, and through the rest of the lesson, I want to try to persuade us all that this is the case, that this is what the ideal life is for a Christian. But if it is the case, I think there are several big advantages to seeing this as the ideal life. One is that this one over here on the right, Jesus' life, is not bound by situations. It's not bound by circumstances. You think about this typical ideal life. This one is so easy to fail in. There are so many things, so many circumstances that are beyond our control that would cause us to miss this ideal life. A good family. You may have been born into a family that was not a good family, so maybe right off the bat, you missed the one that would have made your life ideal. It could be close friends. You can do a lot to cultivate friends, but there's a lot of people who just don't have close friends, and it's not even their fault. Economic stability, there's a lot of people who work really hard and never have that one. A fulfilling job, sometimes you have it and sometimes you don't, and sometimes you can make a lot of decisions that'll get you to that point, and sometimes you can't. Free from tragedy, we can't pick that one. And so many different things in here that are just beyond my control. And so if this is my picture of an ideal life, I may end up being perpetually unhappy that I never get there. Another part of this is that this is so universally obtainable that it doesn't matter whether you're male, female, old, young, rich, poor, whoever you are, this is something you can pursue and obtain, which is neat. It's an ideal, but it's an ideal that's within everybody's grasp. It's even something that if you start late in your life, that maybe you spent most of your life pursuing this one over here, it's possible to turn your life around and end up your life pursuing this one over here on the right. So really interesting to think about just the contrast between Jesus's life that he lived versus what we would typically think of as the life that we all want to live. So what I want to do with the rest of this lesson is try to show that for New Testament Christians, this is really the life that they pursued. And that this life over here, this wasn't a set of goals that they were particularly looking for. That these were the main goals. And sometimes these fell into place, sometimes they didn't. But over here, this is what they were striving towards. So I want to do that from the book of Philippians. So open your Bibles to Philippians chapter 1. And with the rest of the lesson, I just want to work our way through Philippians. We're going to hit little highlights. And my goal is, by taking this one book of the Bible and showing the way this book of the Bible matches up so clearly with this list on the right and just doesn't seem to quite fit with this verse list on the left, I hope to persuade all of us that this is where our focus needs to be. Now, As we do that, I think one of the reasons that we're hesitant to accept this list on the right and to give up this list on the left is because if you stand back and look at that, this one doesn't look very fun. This one looks enjoyable, which is why it's the ideal. This one doesn't look all that enjoyable. There's lots of things on here that just look, this one looks hard. I hope that by the end of this lesson, you'll see from the book of Philippians that this, in fact, is an extremely enjoyable way to live your life when you do it the way the book of Philippians describes it. So, let's talk about the book of Philippians. And here's the way I've titled it, The Joy of Living Like Jesus, from the book of Philippians. So, start in Philippians chapter 1. And in this, we're going to start with this first section over here. I describe this first section as Paul's shockingly cheerful outlook. Here's Paul describing his life to the Philippians towards the beginning of this letter. And he has what I see as just this unusual amount of cheerfulness. Unusual to the fact that point that I would say it's shocking that he could be cheerful in these circumstances. All right, so first of all, he's writing from prison. And yet he's just so cheerful in this letter. And here's the text, it's verse 12 through 30, but I'm just going to summarize some highlights. We may read a little pieces of it, but I want to just summarize some highlights, and you can kind of glance over it and see what I'm talking about. So first thing in there is he talks about his circumstances, and he says, I want you to be aware that what my circumstances of being locked in prison, it's actually worked out really well. Now I'm able to spread the gospel more. So that's the first thing that's kind of surprising is he looks at his situation in prison, and he says, hey, this is actually pretty good. The next thing that happens in that text is he talks about some people who are trying to cause misery to him. And we don't have a lot of background on that, but apparently somebody is out there trying to make his life harder. And then he turns around and says, well, you know, as long as they're still preaching the gospel, I'm totally fine with it. And so that's a strange thing. But then you go further in, and he talks about how he's not sure what's going to happen, whether he's going to get out of prison or whether he's going to be killed for Christ. So that's a big difference. Is he going to be released or is he going to die? And then he describes how, you know, for me, either way. Here, I'll read the real famous section of that. Here's what he says in verse 21. For to me, to live is Christ and to die is gain. If I am to live on in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and to be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. All right, there's a lot in there. He's saying how, you know, for me, if I get to live, well, wonderful. I get to serve Christ. If I die, well, then I get to be with Christ. So it's just this incredibly cheerful attitude about really any situation. And he says, but you know, if I do live here, then I could serve you all, and that would be good. So with all these different things, he's talking about just kind of all the possible options, and he seems to just be happy about any of them, whether he's locked up in prison, whether he's beheaded, I mean, whatever happens, he's good with it. And you think about that. Does that look anything like that first set of goals that we had? I mean, to me, he's not really achieving much of any, maybe a little bit on the list that we first started out with, but barely any. But if you line it up with Jesus's life, you start to have all these parallels. You have, for example, the mission, how Jesus pursued this mission all the way to death. That's what Paul did. He's serving Jesus all the way to, even if it leads him to prison, he's still serving Jesus. Even if it leads him to death, he's still serving Jesus. So a lot of similarities there. We can say that the serving others really matches up, where he's like, if I don't die, well, then I still get to serve you. Or we could say the close relationship with Christ, that here he's saying, for me to live is Christ, that his life is just all about Jesus. And if he dies, he gets to be with Jesus. So it's very much a life that's focused on this relationship. So it's interesting that this very joyful person here has so many similarities to Jesus's, the main points of Jesus' life. All right, let's go a little further. One other thing on that. When you get to the end of that chapter, and we won't read that, but if you get to the end of it, you have that verses that we read this morning, where he says, it's been granted to you to suffer with him. That you have this idea that after Paul describes his life and all the suffering that he's going through, then he's like, oh yeah, and by the way, you guys are getting to suffer too. And he's like, isn't that great too? So it's interesting that this description of his life is not just about his, but he just assumes that all Christians are kind of through these same sort of goals. All right, well, let's move on to the next chapter. Let's think about chapter 2. Chapter 2, Paul has what I call here his surprising relationship advice. Paul wants to teach the Philippians how to have better relationships with each other, how to get along better with each other. And he starts it out, well, let me read the first little part of this. In chapter 2, verse 1, he says, so if there is any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any affection and sympathy, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. We get the word joy in there again. He says, complete my joy. He says, here's what I really want. Here's what makes me happy. It's when I see people who are just getting along together, who really love each other. They're on the same page with each other. They're working well together. That makes me happy. And I think we could all advice. And it doesn't sound fun at all. If the first couple verses were the fun part, the rest of the chapter sounds like how to not have fun. So here's what he says. Verse 3, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death, on a cross. So he says, here's this great example of how to have a great relationship. Be like Jesus. He started out, he had everything, and then he lost everything. And then he went and became a servant. And then he suffered and he died on a cross. That's the route to a great relationship. And we think, well, isn't there another route? That sounds like not really. This is Paul's recipe for great, strong relationships. Now, here's what I think it's neat. You take what his advice that he gives here, and you line it up with Jesus' life, and of course it lines right up because he's saying, just be like Jesus. And it goes right along with what we said was the first point in Jesus' life here, the fact that he lowered himself and humbled himself and became a human being instead of being up there in heaven in all of the glory. So here Paul is applying Jesus' life, this ideal of who Jesus was, and saying, all right, that's the ideal that we need to live out every day in order to have these great, joyful kind of relationships. So while before, when you just look at this list, you say, well, that doesn't look like any fun at all. When you see what Paul's doing with it, and you see that he's saying, no, that's this is the secret to great relationships. All of a sudden, we see how that actually does create this wonderful, joyful life. That when we can give up ourselves and just make our lives all about serving each other, that's when we really do have that great relationship with your husband or with your wife or with your friends or whoever, whatever kind of relationships you have. It's when we live out this kind of ideal life of just total submission and humility. All right, well, let's move that on to, serving others. That's the other part of that. The serving others, of course, is the other big part. All right, let's move on to the next one. This one's negative. Later on in chapter 2, Paul brings up this little negative example of something he just can't stand. Here's the way I say it. Here's something Paul can't stand: people seeking their own interests. And so here's what Paul says. Let me read this one. for they all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. So he says there's these some people who they don't seem to be caring about what Jesus wants. They just care about what they want. And he says, here's the problem I'm having. He says, I'm going to send Timothy to you all to help you all out. But Timothy's the only one I can send to help you because everybody else around here, they don't want to come help you because they just want to do what they want to do. And they're not that concerned about what Jesus wants them to do. Now, how much does this kind of picture look like this list? Pursuing my own interests. Nothing. There's nothing on this list about pursuing my own interests. I mean, really, this is diametrically opposed to this. This one's all about submitting myself to God's interests. But really, none of this lines up with Paul's concept of these people who are just pursuing their own interests. In fact, if we put that other list on the board, that first one we had, where we wanted all those big ideal things that everybody wants, that would look a little bit more like pursuing my own interests. But this one, not so much. All right, that's interesting. Let's keep going here. And chapter 2, later on in chapter 2, he gives us a positive example. He just gave us a negative example. He gives us a positive example of what he sees as really, this ideal life. And this is a real person that he mentions, and he kind of mentions him as a role model. Hey, here's a guy that you should really hold up in high regard because what he's doing is great. All right, so what is it that's great? Philippians chapter 2, verse 29. Let's read that. It says, so receive him in the Lord with all joy. This is, oh, by the way, this is talking about Epaphras, or Epaphroditus. So he says, he tells the Philippians, so receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor such men. For he nearly died for the work of Christ, to me. So he says, here's someone who you really should honor. This guy, Epaphroditus, he nearly died serving Christ. And he did it, he was serving me, and he worked so hard to serve me, he almost died in the process. Wow. And Paul says, that's great. That's the kind of ideal that we really like here. Nearly died? Nearly killed himself? And if you read the verses earlier, what happened was that Epaphroditus went to go help Paul and went to Paul's prison cell and was helping him, and he ended up getting really sick. So sick he almost died from it. But then he finally got better. And Paul says, look at that. That's a guy who's really living the Christian life. So you think about how that lines up with our ideals. How much does that ideal line up with our first list? I mean, there was nothing on that first list about nearly dying to serve Christ. It's absent. But on this list, it looks like a lot of things. I mean, it definitely looks like the just complete devotion to serve others. It also, of course, looks like devotion to the mission all the way to death. So here again, we see that what the early Christians saw as the ideal life, the life that kind of needs to be honored and seen as this is our role model, it doesn't look like what we usually think of as the ideal life. It looks like Jesus. All right, let's keep moving on. Chapter 3, Paul's joy in losing. Chapter 3 is an interesting chapter. Paul describes his life a little bit. He talks about there's some people there he's really concerned about that don't seem to be teaching Christianity correctly. And Paul, as you go through the chapter, Paul eventually turns from what they're teaching to his example of how he's lived the Christian life. And he talks a lot about him giving things up. Here's what he says in Philippians chapter 3, verse 7. He says, but whatever gain I had, I counted as loss for the sake of Christ. All right, this gain, if you went back a few verses, you'd see some of these things. He talks about just all the stuff he had achieved and things that his culture looked at as really being great things. Things like the fact that he was a Hebrew, that he was knowledgeable of the law, that he was a Pharisee, these kinds of things. He had a great education. He was pretty high up in society. I mean, those kinds of things, those were valued in that society. And he says, all those things, I gave them up. Why did you give them up, Paul? He says, for the sake of Christ. That's why I gave up all those things. And it's verse 8, he says, indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord. For his sake, I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes through faith in Christ, the righteousness of God that depends on faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and may share his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that by dead. I didn't use this verse this morning, but we definitely could have. It's a verse that talks about Paul choosing suffering. I gave up all these things so I could pursue Christ and I could share his sufferings. This conscious choice to share Jesus' sufferings. All right, so you look at that description. Paul's just telling us, hey, here's what my life looks like. Here's the story of my life. How much does that fit our original ideal of what the life should look like? I mean, nothing. It doesn't look like that. Now, if you ask Paul, if he said, oh, Paul, I'm so sorry, I feel like you've missed the ideal life, Paul. Paul would say, no, you've missed it. Don't you see that this is the ideal life? And so you match it up with what we saw with Jesus' life, and it sounds exactly like lowering yourself, just like Jesus lowered himself. That's what Paul does. He gives up all this stuff in order to gain Christ. And then, of course, this going all the way to death, this mission of, he says, that I may even share in his death. Well, verse 10, becoming like him in his death. I mean, very much, he's like, I want to imitate the whole entire life of Jesus. That's my ideal life, all the way down to the death part. And then he says, verse 11, that by any means, he wants his life to end in that victory. All right, well, that's, something that's very diametrically opposed to what you might typically see as the ideal life. But then he gives us a window back into what we might think of as the ideal life. He gives us another thing that he can't stand. In verse 17, he talks about people who he says are opposed to the cross. Here's what he says, verse 17. Brothers, join in imitating me and keep your eyes on those who walk according to the example you have in us. All right, that's a really key verse. The whole thing that he said in our previous point, that was not him just talking about himself. He's saying, imitate that. He's saying, that's an ideal that I want you all to have as well. So as Christians, he says, this is ideal life. This giving up and all of that. All right, verse 18. For many of whom I have often told you and now tell you even with tears, walk as enemies of the cross of Christ. Their end is destruction, their God is their belly, and their glory is their shame, with minds set on earthly things. All right, he's just so frustrated here. He says there's these people who are enemies of the cross. Now, what does that mean? You think, enemies of the cross. So it means, you think, well, maybe that means they don't like religion or they don't like Jesus. What does the cross represent? At this time period, the cross is not a piece of jewelry that you hang around your neck. These were not people who as he's using it here, is representing Jesus' suffering. And that's exactly what Paul's been talking about imitating. He's becoming like Christ all the way to his death. And here are some other people who are enemies of that suffering, enemies of that kind of lifestyle. And what is it they pursue instead? He said they have their mind set on earthly things. He says their God is their belly. So what is it they worship? They worship the indulgence, the give me more stuff. They worship the comfortable life, the life that has all of my needs met, the life that shuns suffering, that says, you know, if I could just have a little bit more money so that I could live comfortably, then my life would be perfect. That's these people here. And you line up these people's life with everything that Jesus lived for. And like Paul says, they're opposed to this. There's nothing in common at all. They've become enemies of this kind of life because they're in such a pursuit of a life that has nothing in common with this. That that list over there doesn't match up at all with who these people are. All right, well, let's look at one final point as we get into chapter 4. Turn over to chapter 4. And in chapter 4, there's a lot of instruction, but I just want to focus in on the scripture reading that Blake read for us. I've titled this the seemingly impossible command, although I wish I hadn't said command. I probably should have said example, because I don't think he technically commands it, but he holds it up as an example for us to follow. So this seemingly impossible example that Paul ends his letter with. And I think it's a verse that most of us are really familiar with, but my guess is most of us, as we read it, we feel like, how would I ever get there? I have so far to get there. This just seems utterly out of my reach. All right, so let me read it. Verse 10. I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at length you have revived your concern for me. You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. All right, so what verse 10 is talking about is the Philippians had actually sent a present of money to Paul while he was in prison because he needed help. And so they try to financially support him through that hard time. And so verse 11, not that I'm speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. Wow. He says, I've learned that whatever situation I'm in, to be content. Now, is that not one of the most difficult examples in all the Bible to follow? Whatever situation you're in, to be content. I mean, how many of us could say, yeah, any situation? Well, as soon as I might be able to mentally say that, once I read his list of things that he says after that, I have to back up and say, maybe not. All right, here's what he says, verse 12. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. He's not just talking about, you know, I had kind of a bad day today, but I'm still content. He's saying, no, I could go to the point of going hungry, and I'm still content. That's how far he takes this idea that total suffering, that being penniless, to not even having enough money to buy my next meal, and I'm okay with that. I'm content with that. Who's going to be content with that? Excuse me. Let me blow my nose real quick. All right. Who's going to be content with that? This How do you get to that point? What could you do to be content in every circumstance? He ends it by saying, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. It's only through Jesus' power that I can get to that point. So here's what I think about. When I look at this very challenging example, and I think about this list over here, I think about what makes this example so complicated, so difficult, so unobtainable. I think it has a lot to do with what I'm starting with as my ideal. If I'm starting with my ideal as being that list that we began with, that list of, you know, the great family, the great job, the great money, all that kind of stuff, if that's my ideal, then how would I ever get to this point? Because there are lots of things in my life that would not be ideal, and if they're not ideal, how could I be content? I mean, I could say, well, it's not really ideal, but I guess I'm okay with it. But really, I'm constantly saying, I'm okay with it, but I just need this and this and this and this and this. That's not what Paul says. He says, I've learned that even if I'm hungry, I'm still content. Why? Because his ideal over here, all of these points could be met regardless of his circumstances. Whether he has enough to eat or doesn't have enough to eat, he can still fulfill every one of the points on this list. It's not bound by his circumstances. And to me, that's the value of this kind of list here. That as he holds on to this close relationship with God and says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, it's no longer about the circumstances at all. All right, let's wrap it up like this. We started with... All right, it gave out finally. It's dead. All right, here we go. We started with this list of here's what we often have as the ideal. Here's kind of what is typical for the ideal, and then here's Jesus's ideal. And we said that, you know, while we can see the wisdom in this one on the right, the one on the left just feels like it's a lot more fun. What I hope by looking through this one letter, just looking through the book of Philippians, you can do this with lots of letters in the New Testament, but just by this one little sample, I hope you see one is, for the New Testament Christians, this one on the right is what they were pursuing. This one on the left, some of those things fell into place, but that was not what their goal or pursuit was. It wasn't Paul's goal. He assumed it wasn't the Philippians' goal either. And sometimes when people really made this their goal, he had a big problem with it because it turned into a very selfish lifestyle. But the other thing we said is, Philippians on all this, is that Paul proves to us that this is where real joy is found. That if I'm pursuing this one on the left, I'm going to constantly be unhappy. There's all sorts of things on this list that I'm going to fail at, and it's going to make me feel like I'm never quite there, and it's a struggle that's never, I'm never winning, I'm always losing, and that's not fun. But if I make this list over here my priority, my ideal, my goal, there's real joy in all of that. I mean, just look at Paul's life. He could even be in up, and as he told us how to sacrifice yourself for relationships, all these things were just filled with joy. So my prayer for all of us is that we take the time to rethink kind of what our ideal life is and to retrain ourselves to be more on this side on the right and less on the side on the left, both for us, for our kids, for our grandkids. I mean, just making this the new priority of here's what I want my goals, my ideals in my life to look like. Let's all work on that. Let's live a life that's in total pursuit of Jesus, even if it involves suffering, a life that really is about following him and his example. If you're not a Christian, then we want to invite you to come forward and to give your life to Jesus this evening, to choose to follow him, to really follow him through every circumstance, to follow him wholeheartedly with complete devotion. Please come forward while together we stand and sing.